And you're back on Filter. This is Paul Rice. And on the line with me, I've got Trent Diamante. Trent, are you there? And am I saying your last name correctly? Because I've never said it out loud before.
No, you nailed it perfectly. Oh, and yes, I am here.
I'm glad you're here, and that's not just a voice in my head, Trent. I am very, very pleased with that information. Well, where does Diamante come from? What's up with it's a really cool because I want to say diamond, you know, like
you're gonna ask me this on air, Paul.
I guess you don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me on air.
I'll give you the quick and short of it. It's a bit so it's an Italian last name, it's the plural of diamond.
Nice.
But as fate would have it, I am not Italian. Not even like a little bit. My parents are a couple of eccentrics who couldn't decide on whose last name to pick, and so picked a new one associated with an ethnicity that they have no ancestry of.
That's kind of rad, actually. I mean, I love that, although I'm sure it has made some difficulty for you at points where they're like, well, what region of Italy are you, which Diamantes are you from?
Oh, yeah, exactly. It definitely has caused that. Yeah, it's a very postmodern last name. And I've had people be like, oh, fellow Paisano, and I tell them the story, and they're like, oh, slightly crestfallen. And then and then later they're like, hey, Paisan, and they've like completely forgotten, and I'm just like, okay, let's play pretend.
Well, yeah, I mean, do you pretend to be Italian from time to time just to satisfy that or just to not have the conversation?
I have a few times, but when you encounter that person recurringly, you realize that's kind of a bad idea.
Yeah.
So I've steeled myself. I've really disciplined myself to give the talk each time.
Got it. So you have like a talk. You have it's all prepared.
Oh, yeah.
It's all ready to go.
Yeah. No, I don't need notes for it at this point. I've said it so many times.
Have you thought about like genetically modifying your DNA so you actually legitimately are Italian, and then you could actually be honest and say, yeah, I'm Italian.
I haven't thought of that, but you might have just changed my life.
Well, I was thinking about...
I did do 23andMe a couple of years ago and, like, found out for sure I'm, like, not at all Italian.
0.0%?
Yeah. Like, I thought maybe I'd find, like, oh, some, you know, guy from Sicily slept with one of my relatives in 1800. Nope. All British Isles, baby.
I can't even get, like, an adulterous, off... Yeah, you can't even get a 0.001 on it.
Nope.
Well,
I can't even get a rounding error. It's brutal.
I read the other day that Arm and Hammer, ARMAND, who's Armie Hammer, the famous actor's father, actually ended up buying stock in the company that owns Arm and Hammer just so people would stop asking him if he was involved. In the thing, even though it was named like 30 years before he was named Arm & Hammer, he was just not having it anymore to the point where he bought like a controlling interest in Arm & Hammer baking soda. So,
well, hopefully soon capitalism will allow me to change my ethnic identity just the way it helped out Armie Hammer's family.
Yeah, I hope so too. It could be like that book Jennifer Government where everyone's last name, nobody has last names. They just have the last name of like Nike or government in the case of Jennifer.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yeah.
So you would be Trent Windermere. Which is better than
Paul,
Trent First Federal.
That we work at the same place.
Oh man. Oh no, but everyone strike that from the record, man. Oh, live again and already just exposing the world.
No, you just exposed the incestuous nature of Port Townsend media.
God, ugh, it's sickening. Well, we have some real good stuff to talk about today. So, you know, everyone will forget that we exposed ourselves live on radio.
Oh, thank goodness. Yeah, I'll really give my despairing topic the what it deserves in order to just, you know, put all those happy, mischievous thoughts to rest.
Well, I got to say, you're also my first live guest in like 3 weeks since Christmas.
Ooh.
So it feels really good. As much as I enjoy talking to my guests pre-recorded, it was also like, I knew it was pre-recorded. It was the middle of the night. So talking live, man, makes all the difference. So I'm really thankful that you're here. And I'm also thankful because you're here on a topic that I think is something for you, a point that you've been very I would say brave and courageous in speaking out about this, coming from a perspective of trying to help people and, kind of destigmatize something, which is really obviously a huge stigma still in this day and age, even given how, and we're talking about the opioid epidemic. So Trent, it was a few months ago, or was it a year ago that you wrote your op-ed in the Leader?
Yeah, it was like a little over a year ago, I think, a year and a half.
And in that op-ed, can you tell us a little bit about that op-ed and what led you to wrote it, and maybe give us some background along with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So so there's a big fight going on in SQIM right now over building a medication assisted treatment facility for people suffering from opioid use disorder, more commonly known as just like opioid addiction. And there's a huge uproar in the community about it. There's a big pressure group called Save Our SQIM, which is just adamant, needs to not be built. It's going to attract homeless people. It's going to destroy the, like, sleepy little retirement community they love so much. And I was an opioid addict. I was for about a year and a half of my life. And that includes doing heroin, too. I was also addicted to heroin for the last 4 months of that. And reading, hearing about that really just bummed me out. I mean, I availed myself of medication-assisted treatment, going cold turkey, trying to quit opioids in the long term without help from medication is an incredibly dicey proposition. There's innumerable studies that show it just doesn't work very well. That is like, I think of a less than 10% rate of success is often given. And in the meantime, it can actually kind of, trying to quit cold turkey can increase mortality. That the vast majority of people relapse, and when you relapse after a period of abstaining cold turkey, you're really likely to have an overdose. So anyway, so when this happened, a friend of the show, Nat Jacob, who's a good friend of both of ours.
Yes.
He really wanted to go attend this community meeting about the subject. And I somewhat reluctantly went along because just the thought of being in a room with hundreds of people who want to deny people this kind of treatment just really horrified me. And I went, and I was actually kind of heartened by being there. I mean, I didn't work up the courage to go up there and speak and give a personal testimony. But a lot of people did. And Collin County, where SQIM was located, has a huge opioid problem. I mean, declassified DEA records showed that a gigantic amount of pills flowed into there. So I was kind of heartened by it. There was a lot of what I, expected with dread. But there was also a lot of great stories from young people, from people of all ages, urging it to be built, and from people in the profession, urging as well, who've had personal experiences treating people. So I ended up tried to strike a positive note, wrote a little piece for the Leader that got published, and I was really taken aback by the response it got. At the time, I was working as a banker at First Federal, and my boss there, Luxme, who's still branch manager there, was super supportive, and everybody else. I never got, the slightest hint from the bank that they were concerned about me putting that out there. And if anything, they were really encouraging. And a lot of clients really were. I mean, luckily I was kind of an established person before that happened.
Yeah. I just
So yeah, so that's how that played out.
Well,
yeah.
No worries. Just a conversation. And you, like, when all the Save Our SQIM folks got together under Jody Wilkie, I think, to really protest this, their point was, it's, of course, we need treatment for people who are suffering from opioid addiction, but Squim isn't the place because it'll attract homeless people and, you know, criminals and all these things. And so, I mean, you know, coming from your own perspective, I mean, like, because you were, you know, you were using and you were an addict for a period of time. I mean, were you a criminal in that time too? Were you, I mean, does their argument have any weight there that, that automatically the MAT clinic, which, would attract, an element that would upset and destroy Squim?
Well, so yeah, that was partly why my experience really caused me to see their fight against it as being really, if maybe well-intentioned, but severely misguided. I mean, I don't want to overly emphasize my experience because I was a pretty high-functioning addict. But one thing that's taught me and that's borne out by a lot of research and a lot of the amazing reporting that's gone on about the opioid epidemic, the huge percentage of the users are really high-functioning. And I went to a medication, a treatment facility somewhat similar to the one they're proposing building that probably will be built. And the one I went to was, it was not, you know, it wasn't as well funded. It wasn't as nice as this one's going to be. Most of the people there were kicked there through the criminal justice system. And yet I never felt, I went there, you know, monthly for 4.5 years. That's how long I was on Suboxone, which is the drug I was used for my medication assisted therapy that I slowly tapered down on. I never felt unsafe once. I spent countless hours in that waiting room with other patients. I think this whole notion that it's going to hurt the community is really misguided. There's been a ton of studies in how those kind of clinics affect property values in the communities they're in. There was one study with very loose controls that suggested on average about like a 14-15% decline in property values. But that has not been replicated or borne out by a ton of other research. And the whole thing just seems so misguided to me because, I mean, opioids are a huge problem in Squim and the rest of Clallam County. And I think the location Squim makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's one of the population centers of Clallam, and it's pretty well positioned close to the other population centers. I'm pretty convinced it's a good idea.
and the argument that people will be bussed there, obviously, is something that, I mean, all of this to me so much seems like it's founded on people's ideas or alternative facts, as Kellyanne Conway would say, about how this treatment would work, and without a lot of grounding in reality. I mean, would you say that, like, when you have to talk to people about being, you know, an addict, a recovered addict, but, you know, it's still the same. Like, do you feel there's a stigma? You're always an addict. And I understand that from having some fair number of.
Well, and it's kind of an attitude as someone in recovery you sort of need to have, too, because, I mean, most days I think about using opioids at some point. And it's something that stays with you that you always have to be on your guard against. But it's also, but the nice thing is people meet me. I mean, I kept it secret for a long time. Like, I, as a user, only a few close friends knew, and they thought I was doing much smaller amounts than I did. And then when I was into treatment, I mean, I didn't even tell my parents until I was already in treatment for a few months. But when people get to know you as a person and it's not the first thing they find out about you, it really changes their views. And that's what's kind of motivated me to sort of take up this crusade, is how positive that response is. I had a really heartening experience back when, you know, I was probably in my second or third year of treatment. I was still working at the restaurant, and I overheard some people dining outside talking about how they don't believe in, like, the government paying for Narcan, which is this, a dose of Narcan costs $50 and it instantly reverses, an opioid antagonist that instantly reverses an overdose, and in most cases, when administered properly, will save someone who otherwise would have died. They didn't believe in the government spending money on that. It was just like a waste. And I went up to him and told him, you know, I'd been their server. I went up to him, told him, like, hey, I was an addict. I'm telling you, this is a really cost-effective way to save lives.
Wow.
And, you know, they went from, like, addicts are barely people to, thank you so much for sharing. That's really, you know, changed how I feel. And that was a really, really heartening early experience for me. That also helped me kind of cope with and help get over the intense shame I felt and still feel over having been swept up, having been addicted for a while.
Well, I'm sure you've heard other addicts say that you taking a stand like that. I mean, it's so courageous, you know, like, and you don't need lauding for that. I know, because you're a self-assured person in this part of your life, in the rest of your life. But, you know, I mean, I think it's huge, and I do commend you for it. And I think it's also part of how maybe this will be something we talk about more in the second half, how we can destigmatize the use of drugs,
right,
for people, you know, to they understand that this isn't something where it's like, yeah, I think it'll be cool to be a drug addict, where it's just more like,
no,
you have pain, just like any addiction. You have pain that needs to be medicated, and that pain is medicated for you in lots of different ways. And it's not always drugs that is the feature of addiction.
No,
it can be so many other things.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And, like, you know, a lot of the story of the opioid epidemic is well told, at least a certain side of it, which is, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, especially Purdue Pharmaceutical, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, which made OxyContin, really kind of pushed for this reevaluation of doctors and how they prescribed it. And suddenly the market was flooded with opioids, and it was being prescribed for things that it normally wasn't prescribed for. And there was a big change there. But I think a lot of what's missing in our account of the epidemic is that there's, like, a real mental health crisis in this country. Like, I have a big overarching view of this. I think there's really a crisis of loneliness.
Mm.
You know, if you've heard of the bullying alone thesis, Robert Putnam's book, I believe came out in 2000, about the decline, he assembles a ton of evidence showing for the decline of, like, community associations, you know, church attendance, all these kind of, like, thick things that bind people together. But some of the data he shows in that book is just about people not spending as much time face-to-face with other people. I mean, this book came out in 2000, and he pinned a lot of the blame on TV for this decline that's been occurring since the late 60s. But I'm convinced that, like, the internet and computers and smartphones have accelerated it. And there's some really disturbing figures out there. Now, I saw one, the percentage of people who say they don't have anyone they're close to was polled at 9% in 2013, and the most recent poll put it at 17%. And I think it's all kind of engendering this crisis of loneliness, which is causing a mental health crisis. And opioids are especially alluring for really lonely people. They're not a party drug. I mean, you can be social on them. Lots of people are, but they're really, I mean, there's a great line in this book, Dreamland, which is came out in 2015 about the opioid epidemic. I strongly urge people to read, talking about, like, you know, the spot, the opioid use, the stereotypical kind of opioid use location now. It isn't an inner city shooting gallery, you know, like a row house, a abandoned row house that a bunch of people are hanging out shooting up in. It's like somebody's bedroom in their parents' house, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. And I think those things are really well connected. There's the, I can't remember his name, but the Surgeon General under Obama has been going around a lot talking about crisis of loneliness. He's very reluctant to say it's on the rise. But I think if you look at the things that cause loneliness, and we can see all of those are clearly on the rise, I think there's a connection there.
Well, we're talking to Trent Diamonte about the opioid epidemic, crisis of loneliness, and his own personal experiences, and the Matt Clinic here on Filter. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM. We're going to take a little music break. Trent brought us a song, and I found a clean version of it. Trent, you want to introduce the song for us? I think it's a great choice.
So the song, I really wanted a song that would be on the theme here. So I picked the song Drug Ballad from Eminem's second album, Marshall Mathers LP. He himself was an opioid addict and a benzodiazepine addict, too, which is like Xanax or Valium, who's now in recovery and has been sober for a while. I picked it because the song is about kind of, it's a really, even though it was written back when he was an addict and long before he got clean, it's a really kind of honest and self-aware look at it, at things and how you get caught up in drug use. And I think it's a song, you know, a lot of his early stuff, the rampant homophobia doesn't age too well. But I think this is one that's stood the test of time.
All right. This is Drug Ballad by Eminem. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more from Trent on Filter on KPTZ.
Washington State's Department of Health now offers WaNotify, the simple, anonymous exposure notification tool to help stop the spread of COVID-19. The privacy-preserving technology works without collecting or revealing any personal data or location. WaNotify can be easily enabled in iPhone settings or downloaded as an app for Android phones. More information at doh.wa.gov.
Back on Filter with Trent Diamante, Paul Rice, talking about the opioid epidemic. We just listened to a clean version of Eminem's Drug Ballad, which only included about half the words of the song bleeped out, but still we get the sense. And during the music break, Louisa sent me this interesting thing about from Psychiatric Times, what does Rat Park teach us about opioid addiction? And so I just glanced at the article really, really quickly, but, you know, everyone knows this, or most people know about these experiments where they gave rats, you know, water that had, you know, coke in it and water that just had water in it. And then the rats just overdosed on the drugs. But then he tried this other version of it, and I'll just read this paragraph. Alexander, the guy who initiated the study, wondered, is this about the drug, or might it be related to the setting they were in? To test his hypothesis, he put rats in rat parks, where they were among others and free to roam and play, to socialize, and to have sex. Ooh. And they were given the same access to the same two types of drug-laced bottles. When inhabiting a rat park, they remarkably preferred the plain water. Even when they did imbibe from the drug-filled bottle, they did so intermittently, not obsessively, and never overdosed. A social community beat the power of drugs. And I thought that was very related to what we were talking about, Trent, what you were talking about there in the culture of loneliness, that we're feeling surrounded by screens and not even sure who our friends really are, or even where they are. Or what they mean when they texted us that last emoji. So,
Yeah,
I mean, like, how do we, given that we're coming into this culture, and I don't know if the culture of screens is going to make us ultimately more connected or less connected. And I throw away there's some garbage to the argument that says, like, that we should somehow, I mean, we can't dial back the technology. We can simply make the technology connect us better, you know, and in ways that is less psychologically damaging. We can improve it. We I don't want to set off an EMP bomb and get rid of all technology and get rid of the screens. I want the screens to really be able to sort of salvage our humanity down the line. And maybe that's asking too much from Jeff Bezos, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, where do you see as like, how do we fight against this culture of loneliness that may be encouraging the opioid epidemic to grow even stronger?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, there isn't an easy answer to that. You know, that's definitely an area where policy interventions are a lot trickier. For sure. I don't have an easy answer for that. I think at this stage, it's something we got to be aware of and like investigate and try to, you know, make effort. I know for me, when I was first in treatment, I realized there was, you know, I needed to fix that I had been lonely. When my use really spiraled out of control, I had had a bunch of friends move away. I was living on Whidbey Island at the time and I had a few friends move away, and I was already using before that, but that's when it got really bad. And I remember within a few months of joining treatment, I started coaching basketball, which has always been one of my big passions of mine. Mm. And that was a big help, kind of plugged me into a community, got me out there meeting people. I started using Tinder and dating a lot more and stuff like that. But yeah, as for addressing it societally, I don't really know I don't have any good answers there. Because, yeah, there are. For treating the opioid epidemic specifically, I do think we need to make Narcan much more widely available. I think we need to make Suboxone. I think we really need to, like, inundate society with Suboxone. That's the drug I took. I think methadone should be, like, a second-line therapy for Suboxone for people who don't tolerate Suboxone well, which is definitely some people. But
is Suboxone less addictive than methadone? Because they're both still addictive, right?
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, both Suboxone and methadone, the reason they work is because they do cause a physical dependency, and they plug up the physical dependency, so you don't go into withdrawals. Suboxone is definitely, among addicts, I can say, with absolute certainty, Suboxone is less desirable for recreational use than methadone.
Mm.
I mean, if you're in a methadone is less desirable than, you know, heroin is, but it definitely can, it's much more easier to abuse. Suboxone rarely causes euphoria, drowsiness, and it's really effective at just blocking up your opioid receptors so that nothing else really gets in. And honestly, if it's tapering off, it is hard, and it can be just putting people on it for the rest of their lives or for long stretches of time is a pretty decent solution. It's so much better than being addicted.
Mm.
And it's a hard drug to relapse on. I mean, you have to abstain from Suboxone for a couple of days before you can really get high on another opioid again.
Mm.
So I think making it much more widely available, I think stop getting rid of these silly fears of Suboxone being, like, diverted to black market use would go a long way towards that. I'm not saying it shouldn't be a controlled substance or anything, but I think that would help a lot. But yeah, for as far as the wider mental health crisis, I mean, I don't know the exact figures, but I know from people like my friend Nat, who works as a lawyer, that there's a real lack of state and federal funding for mental health. And I think we need to see it as something that's, if used well, is likely to pay for itself many times over. But the culture, like you said, winding back technology, trying to change the culture through policy, that's incredibly difficult. And I don't see an easy answer there, but I do think educating people about the importance of being, and destigmatizing loneliness, I think, is a big one too.
Mm.
You know, and
yeah.
And educating people about the importance of, you know, joining groups, joining associations, trying to, you know, the same way you ask yourself, like, oh, have I exercised today, or like, have I eaten, you know, do I need to eat some vegetables? Like, also asking yourself, hey, maybe I need to get some social time. And I think screens can, you know, talking on the phone is still pretty helpful. You know, nothing beats face-to-face in person, but anything helps.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think that there is an issue with access to drugs? Like, is there sort of obviously you're not using it anymore. I'm not trying to say where are good drugs at? but I'm trying to say, that'll come back for me later. but you know, is it an unprecedented issue of access to drugs? Is it really easy to get these, you know, or
right.
is that fueling the crisis versus like people really wanting to use?
That's definitely a big part of it. So,
oh, I think we
really
lost.
Got flooded with pharmaceutical opioids in the 90s and 2000s and early aughts due to a variety of factors, kind of a cultural change in the medical community towards taking pain more seriously, and then also pharmaceutical companies taking advantage of that and trying to make money off that. It's a huge factor. I mean, the problem is now they've done a good job of cracking off down on the pharmaceuticals, but of course the black market heroin and especially the synthetics like fentanyl have really stepped in. I mean, pharmaceuticals are really expensive. If you can't get a prescription, the street price is like $1 a milligram.
Mm.
You know, it's much, much, much cheaper to switch to synthetics and or heroin. And even heroin's getting displaced by the synthetics. I mean, fentanyl is really cheap to make if you have the right lab set up for it. It's really easy to smuggle because it's so strong, like as like a per volume or mass ratio.
Right.
And those are really displaced. I just read a report said in Burma, there's been a 1/3 decline in the amount of opium fields for cultivation, because the farmer, the poor Burmese farmers who depend on opium, which gets refined into heroin and smuggled into the U.S. and Europe and other places, they're being displaced by the factory labs that are making synthetics.
That's fascinating. So, wow. So China is sort of putting these third world farmers out of business with their mass production of fentanyl, which also you need less fentanyl, right? Like a little goes a long way with fentanyl. So supply
absolutely.
Wise. But it's also more likely to lead to an overdose than heroin as well, right?
It is. Yeah. And it's usually fentanyl is not sold as fentanyl. It's sold pressed into a fake pill, you know, or a counterfeit pill, I should say. Or it's sold, you know, heroin that's spiked with it, or it's, you know, it's mixed with some other kind of binder substance that makes it seem like, you know, fine, what they call like number four heroin. And it's very hard to dose effectively for that reason as well. If you're a user trying to get, you know, enough to get your fix, but not so much that you die.
Yeah.
It's a massive development that's going on. It's really changing the market for it. And we're not going to fix it by addressing that supply side, by shutting down the fentanyl producers. It's too easy to make. It's too easy to smuggle. And it's too cost effective. There's too much money to be made on it. Like, we need to go after the demand side. We need to reduce society's demand for these drugs by increasing mental health resources and drug treatment. I mean, we should already know that from the last 50 years of the war on drugs.
Right.
But it's especially true when you have the synthetics in the game.
Well, like I've said repeatedly on this show, all opinions are mine and Trent's, not the station's, but absolutely, you know, when I say legalize all drugs, I mean pretty much that, because that is like, there is no solution that drug enforcement has been able to offer that actually stems or prevents any kind of people who want to use drugs from using drugs. And in fact, all it does is, you know, give money to those Chinese manufacturers. Not that there's anything wrong with China in general, but like, you know, that's where so much of the fentanyl is being shipped from. And Mexican cartels. You know, sending us marijuana, although not as much anymore, thankfully, because of our legalization. It's the only thing that works is taking away the stigma of the user by criminalizing them and making them, you know, creating an avenue to treatment with the money that you're earning as a government by selling that stuff to people who are going to find a way to buy it, and much more dangerously than they would have with than they would if the government was regulating it and in charge of it. It's just, it's an infuriating no-brainer to me that I have to live. And I'm happy for like marijuana legalization. I'm happy for so many of the steps we've made on it, but it's like, to me, it's so obvious. And it's one of those things where I don't get on this high horse very often, but like this, the war on drugs is something that is so plainly obvious to me. And I don't understand why there isn't this sort of like groundswell of everyone saying, yes, Paul's right. Paul's absolutely right. Like, we can solve so many problems just by doing it this way. It's one of those things for me. So,
doing it the right way would be, I mean, extremely important though. Making sure that like, if you can only get it in certain areas, you know, I personally kind of like the solution proffered on season 3 of The Wire, of
Hamsterdam,
kind of having an, yep, Hamsterdam solution. But yeah, it's true. I mean, it would still be, I definitely agree with you, but the implementing legalization properly would be a big challenge, especially to fend off the special interests that potentially could gain so much from it.
Agree. It's not a black or white, like we just legalize it and it's fine. I don't see it as that way, but I, you know, it's that argument that we can say we have all the evidence says enforcement doesn't work. So are you going to keep doing enforcement when we can prove that it doesn't work? When we have been able to prove it doesn't work for 20 plus years? You know,
50 plus years.
50 I mean, plus years. Yeah.
Going back to the Nixon administration.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to make another point here too, about like the scale of the problem. I mean, obviously COVID is the main thing right now. We've lost more than 370,000 people to it, which is a pretty staggering figure. I mean, we're getting close to the amount of Americans who died in World War II. We'll probably exceed that before the pandemic's over. But the opioid epidemic is going to be with us after that. And the figures on a per, you know, the amount of people that have died since the company, since they really loosened up prescribing back in the mid-90s, is going to exceed what died, what Americans died from COVID. I mean, we've got just the figures always lag 2 years behind, but there was almost 70,000 overdose deaths in 2018. And just to put that in perspective, in 2000, there was only around 20,000. So it's massively gone up. And of that 67,000, the vast majority are opioids, probably at least 70%, according to conservative figures. But I've read studies that suggest it's more like 80 or 90% have opioids involved. I mean, usually there's multiple drugs involved because that they tend to synergize together and can mask each other's effects. But we're looking at just a huge problem. We've, you know, pumped trillions into dealing with COVID, and that's great, but we need to, when that dust has settled and we're preparing ourselves for the next pandemic, we need to be serious about dealing with the epidemic that's been going on for the last couple of decades.
Well, we're out of time here, Trent, but I really appreciate you coming on to talk about this, and I hope we can do it again soon, because I, you know, like, this is the only way forward is just two white guys talking about things, right? That was a joke. Oh God. But seriously, I mean, I commend you for your bravery in having these conversations. I know it's natural for you and it comes naturally to you.
Thank
and it's
you.
Part of your healing, but you know, I think, you know, it's a huge part of helping people, deal with the stigma that they continue to have. So thank you so much for your work on this and your willingness to share.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm very sweaty right now because it does make me a bit uncomfortable to talk about it and lay my baggage out there. So I really appreciate that. Thanks for giving me this forum.
Absolutely. Do you have any shout outs before we send you on your way?
Shout out to my friend Ted, who messaged me right before you called me saying, wow, this Paul Rice guy has a real community radio voice.
I don't know if that's a compliment or not, but thank you, Ted.
Yeah.
I've got, you know what? I'm going to think about that. I have a community radio voice. I love it.
Well, let me offer. I think it's a compliment because I was interested in coming on. I mean, it was, my interest in coming on really got spiked when you had Nat Jacob here as the outgoing president of Clemente. And I was really impressed with your interview and the questions you had. And, that really galvanized me into wanting to get on here, knowing, thinking we could have a fruitful conversation.
Well, I believe we have, and I believe we will have again. So, come back and join us soon.
Okay.
And, and thanks. Thank you for being here.
Shout out to my loving wife, Aislinn.
There you go.
Well.
Smart
who
guy. Aislinn, thank you for listening, Aislinn. And Aislinn texted me also with the Jennifer Government reference accolade. So yeah, Jennifer Government. If
nice.
You guys haven't read that book, if any of our listeners haven't, I highly recommend that book. It's great. And with that, we'll send Trent back on his way. Thanks again, Trent.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Take care, brother. All right. This is Filter, KPTZ 91.9 FM. It's Martin Luther King Day on Monday, January 19th, and more important than ever that we remember Martin Luther King. We think about going past Martin Luther King back to slavery, thinking about what this country is founded on, and in honor of that, remembering what people had to escape from, what people of color had to escape from, what indigenous people of color had to escape from, in terms of making this country what it is, this country that frothed over at the mouth last week and showed its true colors. I want to play a Mavis Staples song, Wade in the Water. It's an old runaway slave song. It tells you how to avoid the dogs when you're running away from the plantation. Still running away. So lots of people are still running away. And those people that came to the Capitol last week, they're chasing us and they're chasing our dreams. So let's not forget that. And let's listen to Mavis and think about Martin Luther King Jr. And keep listening. Stay tuned. We're going to talk to Bruce Cowan in the second hour after we remember Martin Luther King. at the top of 2 p.m. So again, this is Filter. I'm Paul Rice. Thank you for listening. As always, here we go.